Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Angus McVicar and I will be reading Time Magazine here on Sight into Sound Radio. We start this week in our milestone section of the magazine. Appointed: Emily's List, President LaFonza Butler by California Governor Gavin Newsom to complete Dianne Feinstein's Senate term. 1. The Nobel Prize in Medicine by two scientists, Kathleen Carrico and Drew Weissman, on October 2nd for their research on mRNA, critical to developing COVID-19 vaccines. Arrested: Dwayne Keith Davis for murder on September 29th. Prosecutors say he ordered the 1996 killing of rapper Tupac Shakur. Warned: people in France about a widespread outbreak of bedbugs in Paris by the government. No one is safe, the city's deputy mayor said on X on September 29th. Suggested: potential ways for Catholic priests to bless same-sex unions with major caveats by Pope Francis in a July letter the Vatican published on October 3rd. Died: Michael Gambon, who played Dumbledore in 6 of the 8 Harry Potter films at aged 82 on September 27th. In political news, our next article is titled After McCarthy, A House in Disarray, written by Nick Popley. When asked the advice he would give the next Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy replied, "Change the rules." The California Republican was addressing the press on October 3rd, the day he lost the job he had held for only 10 months. A decent run for an Italian government, but a mortifyingly brief interval to hold a position that draws power from longevity. The marble edifices of the Capitol campus that surrounded McCarthy as he spoke are named for House speakers like Joe Cannon, Nicholas Longworth, Sam Rayburn, whose grip on the gavel spanned decades. McCarthy held it for 38 weeks. But then the majority is managed by those leaders, two Republicans and a Democrat, were elected when parties, not insurgents, ran politics. For McCarthy, and even more so his successor, the brutal truth was that the rules have already changed. The specific bylaw that McCarthy alluded to is one allowing any member of the Republican conference to call for a vote to recall the speaker at any time. It's a rule McCarthy agreed to in January in the course of being elected, after 15 ballots by a margin of 4 votes. The recall option was the price the former Bakersfield sandwich shop owner paid to win the support of the very far right-wing House members who deposed him 10 months later. But it signalled a larger change, away from governing and toward performance. "My fear is the institution fell today," McCarthy said at his farewell press conference following the 216-210 vote. 8 Republicans had joined the Democrats in voting against him, as punishment for McCarthy's agreeing with Democrats 3 days earlier on a compromise bill that kept the federal government running, just hours before it was to shut down. "They don't get to say they're conservative because they're angry and chaotic," McCarthy said. He singled out Representative Matt Gaetz, the flamboyant Florida Republican who had toyed with McCarthy through the roll calls of January and invoked the rule calling for his removal. "It was all about getting attention," McCarthy said. Yet the next speaker will inherit a house that is not only divided but subdivided, with the GOP's narrow 9-seat majority diminished by an angry split between establishment Republicans and the far-right populist faction egged on by Donald Trump. Add to that a broken power structure that allows even a handful of dissenting members to wield significant influence, and the new dynamic raises concerns whether anyone can lead the House on critical issues. "Being Speaker is never an easy job," says Representative Mike Lawler, a New York Republican. "The question now is, can someone build a consensus and move us forward?" A Speaker of the House had never been stripped of the gavel before McCarthy. Only 2 others had faced a motion to vacate threat to their leadership position, neither of which succeeded, once in 1910 and more recently in 2015. "The Republican Party is in real danger," says Larry Sabato, a political analyst and director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. "They're not going to get very much done in the coming months without a long-term game plan." One of the most contentious issues facing the House is Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky met with President Joe Biden in September and pleaded for new weapon systems, including F-16 fighter jets and longer-range ATACMS missiles. And the White House is asking Congress for $20.6 billion. A small group of House Republicans are vehemently opposed to military aid for Kyiv and have threatened to tank any legislation that would provide it. House Republicans also disagree on how to conduct their impeachment inquiry into Biden over his family's business dealings. McCarthy named Oversight Committee Chair James Comer, a Kentucky Republican, to lead the inquiry under pressure from the far right. Lawmakers may now push to remove him from the investigation. Perhaps most consequential for everyday Americans, the government will shut down if the Republican-led House and Democrat-led Senate fail to reach an agreement to pass 12 annual spending bills by November 17th. This was a difficult job for Kevin McCarthy, says Laura Blessing, a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University. But it's now a far more difficult job for someone else. End of article. In world news, our next article is titled The Human Toll of Poland's Strict Abortion Laws. Since a 2020 ruling by the country's constitutional tribunal, Poland has had a near total ban on abortion. There have been mass women-led protests ever since. The consequences of the reproductive rights rollback have been dire, as doctors hesitate to take life-saving steps for pregnant patients. Krzysztof Sawinski still cries every day since his wife Marta, who was 5 months pregnant, died of sepsis in 2022. He believes doctors waited to act until the fetus's heart had stopped. Janusz Kujarski also lost his partner Justyna to sepsis in the fifth month of a pregnancy. She left behind two boys. With doctors reluctant to intervene, infant mortality rates have also risen. We have seen an increase in infant deaths in the statistics, says Dr. Gisela Jadwiecki, a gynecologist in Olasaka, who performs many of the few legal abortions that still take place in Poland. A recent patient, 6 months pregnant, traveled 250 miles to see her. The baby had almost no lung tissue. It would have died immediately or a few hours after birth, Jadwiecki says. Because the ruling Law and Justice Party supports the restrictions, many Poles look to the October 15th parliamentary elections to produce change. Others look to the courts. Attorney Jolanta Budzwiecki is representing families in criminal negligence cases against doctors in relation to the abortion law. End of article. Under the heading of health, our next article is titled, Five Ways to Tap into Nostalgia's Health Benefits. Written by Angela Haupt. When people walk into Kerry Peel's retro toy store in Albuquerque, New Mexico, their eyes light up. Wooden spinning tops, yo-yos, trolls, rainbow lava lamps, scratch and sniff stickers. It's like time travel unlocked. Some visitors make a beeline for the games and puzzles, eager to relive their glory days. I sell a ton of jacks to grandparents, Peel says. I always joke that I should have an over 50 league, because every single grandma tells me they were the best at jacks. Indulging in this sort of nostalgia offers a host of well-being benefits, experts say. Research suggests that yearning for the past helps us feel more connected to other people while increasing our ability to offer emotional support. Nostalgia can also help us find meaning in life, build self-esteem, and focus more on being true to ourselves. Plus, it can make us happier. Interestingly, it's as much about building a better future as it is the past, experts say. Originally, I said, okay, the best way to think about nostalgia is the psychological defense mechanism. When life is uncertain and unstable, we look to the certainty and comfort of the past, and that makes us feel better, notes researcher Clay Routledge, whose book, Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life, will be published in December. And that's definitely true, but he's also discovered something surprising. When people share nostalgic memories, many are future-oriented. It's looking backwards, Routledge says, but it's because you want ideas for how to move forward. We asked Routledge and other experts to share their favourite ways to tap into nostalgia's benefits. Number 1. Watch old movies. Developmental molecular biologist John Medina sets out to bathe in nostalgic warmth for an hour a day, often watching old Disney movies that he and his mum enjoyed together when he was growing up. Fantasia, Pinocchio, Sleeping Beauty. That's my happy place, he says. Follow Medina's lead and seek out the movies that remind you of a joyful time in your life. Even better, watch them or discuss them with someone else, he recommends. 2. Dine like you did as a kid. In need of dinner plans, load up your plate with a cafeteria-style sloppy joe and some pop rocks and pixie sticks and pair it with a nice glass of purple Kool-Aid. Medina suggests, if anyone asks, call it the nostalgia special. Some research shines light on the data of food nostalgia. Scents, in particular, can evoke nostalgia, while also increasing self-esteem, optimism, and feelings of meaning in life. 3. Create some playlists. Research suggests that people prefer music that was popular when they were in their teens and 20s to songs from before or after that time in their lives. Spend part of your day listening to whatever gets you grooving. Or better yet, Routledge notes, make a playlist of your favourites. That's an example of something that requires a little more active creativity, he says. You're not just listening to nostalgic music, you're intentionally engaging with it. 4. Hit the books. When Peel and her husband started dating, they visited the children's section at the local library and shared their long-ago favourites with each other. She favoured James Marshall's books, including the George and Martha series. He preferred books by Chris Van Allsburg, especially The Garden of Abdul Ghazaza. It was a really cool, fun way to learn about the other person, she recalls, and easily replicated at your own local library. 5. Start a collection. Medina often advises people to start collecting things. The earlier in life, the better. That way, when it comes time for you to retire, you'll have a bunch of objects you can fill a room with, and then just go and sit in as if it were a hot tub, he says. A hot tub for the mind. Objects can uniquely help conjure the past. Plus, collecting is active and social. You might find yourself combing through antique shops or flea markets and interacting with those you encounter along the way. Brainstorm what you're interested in. Vintage Coke bottles, antique dishes, Barbies, train sets, and have fun embarking on your scavenger hunt. End of article. Under the heading of society, our next article is titled Goodbye Columbus. To fully understand the deep roots of the toxic blend of ethno-religious identity politics known today as white Christian nationalism, we need to go back to at least 1493, not the year Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue, but the year he returned to a hero's welcome in Spain, bringing with him gold, brightly coloured parrots, and nearly a dozen captive indigenous people. The return of Columbus also precipitated one of the most fateful theological developments in the history of the Western Christian Church, the creation of what has come to be known as the Doctrine of Discovery. Established in a series of 15th century papal bulls, the doctrine claims that European civilization and Western Christianity are superior to all other cultures, races, and religions. The Doctrine of Discovery merged the interests of European imperialism, including the African slave trade, with Christian missionary zeal. While the doctrine has escaped scrutiny by most white scholars and theologians, indigenous people and scholars of color have long been testifying to these Christian roots of white supremacy, while dying from and living with their damaging effects. As I've continued my own journey of re-education over the past 10 years, I have come to consider the Doctrine of Discovery as a kind of Rosetta Stone for understanding the deep structure of the European political and religious worldviews we've inherited in this country. It furnished the foundational lie that America was discovered and enshrined the noble innocence of pioneers in the story we, the white Christian Americans, have told about ourselves. Ideas such as Manifest Destiny, America as a City on a Hill, or America as a New Zion all sprouted from the seed that was planted in 1493. The sense of divine entitlement of European Christian chosenness has shaped the worldview of most white Americans and thereby influenced key events, policies, and laws throughout American history. The contemporary currency of this worldview is reflected in the telling results of a 2023 Christian Nationalism Survey conducted by PRRI in partnership with the Brookings Institution, which asked, "Do you agree or disagree that God intended America to be a new promised land where European Christians could create a society that could be an example to the rest of the world?" While only 3 in 10 Americans agreed, majorities of Republicans, 52%, and white evangelical Protestants, 56%, affirmed it. Moreover, the survey found that among white Americans today, this belief in America as a divinely ordained white Christian nation, one that has blessed so much brutality in our history, is strongly linked to denials of structural racism, anti-immigrant sentiment, anti-Semitism, anti-LGBTQ sentiment, support for patriarchal gender roles, and even support for political violence. Is America a divinely ordained promised land for European Christians, or is America a pluralistic democracy where all stand on equal footing as citizens? Most Americans embrace the latter version, but a desperate, defensive, mostly white Christian minority continued to cling to the former, lately in the form of Trumpism and the Make America Great Again movement. It was reflected in the prayers and religious symbols participants carried at the U.S. Capitol insurrection on January 6, 2021, and it has become central to the trajectory of the contemporary Republican Party, two-thirds of whom identify as white and Christian. The contemporary white Christian nationalist movement flows directly from a cultural stream that has run through this continent for 5 centuries. In many ways, this truth has always been glaringly apparent. But for those of us who are white and Christian, our precarious position has historically required that we remain vigilantly ignorant of our own origin story while demanding the acquiescence of others. Fragmented narratives demarcate America's Indian problem and Negro problem as distant islands, neither visible from the shores of the other. But if we do the hard work of pushing upriver, we find at the headwaters the white Christian problem. We need a moral imagination that is not amnesiac, one that will hold on to the memory of the systemic injustices that have accrued to black and indigenous people and their forebears. We white Christians no longer represent the majority of Americans. We are no longer capable of setting the nation's course by sheer cultural and political dominance. But there are still more than enough of us to derail the future of democracy in America. End of article. Next, we have the Risk Report, written by Ian Bremmer. How to weigh the risks of a crisis over Taiwan. In January, Taiwan will hold a presidential election. China's leaders hope former New Taipei City Mayor Hui Yui, candidate of the Kuomintang opposition party, will win the job. But the smart money is on current Vice President William Lai, who represents the incumbent Democratic Progressive Party, DPP. Lai and his party favor a tougher approach to Beijing. If Lai wins, Beijing will become much more confrontational in the coming months. A Chinese invasion of Taiwan remains highly unlikely, but a deterioration in relations is bad news for both sides. For now, Beijing is wielding both sticks and carrots to influence Taiwan's voters. China's Navy recently conducted its largest ever military exercises in the Western Pacific, but Beijing has also announced a plan to develop China's Fujian province into a demonstration zone for integrated economic development with Taiwan. This good cop, bad cop strategy probably won't work. Recent polling suggests that about 3/4 of Taiwan's 24 million people now consider themselves Taiwanese rather than Chinese, whatever their family history. A sharp jump over the past 10 years. Some of that trend is likely the natural product of generational change. But China's crackdown on the democracy rights movement in Hong Kong in 2020 has played a role in that shift too. Meanwhile, Taiwan's DPP leaders are looking beyond the election toward the more threatening approach from China. Their latest pushback comes in the form of a new defense report they hope will make China think harder about a future invasion. On September 12, Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense released its National Defense Report 2023, which details the lessons Taiwan has learned from Russia's war in Ukraine. In particular, the report calls for bolstering Taiwan's asymmetric warfare capabilities, including the acquisition of mobile, cost-effective, portable and AI-enabled weapons and equipment. China has also learned lessons from the war in Ukraine. Its leaders recognize that an enemy fighting for its land can make territorial gain prohibitively expensive for the invader, and that Western powers are more likely to align than to divide in the face of naked military aggression. It should also be clear for now that Beijing badly needs to focus its current attention and resources on domestic challenges. Over the longer term, China's President Xi Jinping remains determined to reincorporate Taiwan into China by any means necessary, and he'll respond forcefully to any moves he considers foreign interference in this mission. But Beijing also understands that Washington has domestic challenges too, and will not welcome any pro-independence push by anyone in Taiwan for the foreseeable future. That gives Beijing time to wait for better conditions for decisive action against the island's autonomy. End of article. Next, we turn to Health Matters, written by Haley Weiss, health and science reporter. Depending on whom you ask, Oregon and Washington have been either reckless or trailblazing. In 2021, both states decriminalized possession of all drugs, a highly experimental move amid a growing opioid crisis in the Pacific Northwest. Because no one clear metric captures the dangers of drugs, measuring the impact of these bills isn't so simple. Residents of both states, particularly in major cities like Seattle and Portland, have noticed dramatic increases in visible drug activity since the bills took effect. Quality of life challenges that have been well documented by local and national news outlets. Washington's decriminalization measure has since been rolled back. A pair of new studies, however, suggest that by other metrics, in their first year, the measures may have begun to work as intended. According to an analysis by a team at NYU, neither bill caused any change in the already increasing numbers of fatal overdoses in each state, and promisingly, the decrease in arrests for drug possession led to no increase in arrests for violent crimes. There's always a hope that states function as laboratories of democracy, and when one state does something that makes sense and seems to work, the other states will adopt it, says Corey Davis, an assistant clinical professor at NYU's Center for Opioid Epidemiology and Policy, and a co-lead author on the papers. Arrests went down, overdoses didn't change. To me, that's an improvement over the previously existing system. Perhaps advocates suggest Oregon's experiment just needs more time to breathe. End of article. The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. As House Republicans convened their first hearing of an impeachment inquiry nominally against President Joe Biden, it was pretty obvious that their program was designed to agitate partisans, not persuade Americans. In fact, House Oversight Chairman James Comer all but confirmed as much during that September 27 session. "We want to present evidence," the Kentucky Republican said as the day began. Shot back Representative Jamie Raskin, a Maryland Democrat who was leading voice during both of the impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump. "What evidence? There is no evidence. There are no facts." Then Comer, perhaps not fully appreciating that he sounded like he was conceding the facts in this anti-Biden probe matter less than their packaging, responded, "Just sit back and let the American people see the hearing. Welcome to at least the next year of Congress, where how things look matters more than what they are. The first session offered no new evidence, just innuendo and character indictments. There is no sign that will change. To be clear, first son Hunter Biden may well have been involved in some dodgy deals that bordered on at least perceived criminality. Certainly there were some serious lapses in judgment as he banked on his family's name. Yet even the three witnesses invited by the Republican majority seemed dubious that the oversight team had the goods. sham or not, though this effort is here, and Republicans are going to use it to hammer Biden and fellow Democrats heading into a contentious and uncertain election year. Any serious impeachment investigation or inquiry relies on first-hand sworn testimony of witnesses to high crimes and misdemeanors, said Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Today, the Republican majority has called three witnesses to make their case. She then asked each witness a version of the same question. Are you presenting any first-hand witness account of crimes committed by the President of the United States? The answer, of course, was negative. Not that it really mattered in D.C. End of article. Ukraine shows how drones are changing warfare. Written by Eric Schmidt. War spurs innovation. Observing life and death in Ukraine's battlefield, it's evident to us that modern warfare now transforms its startup speeds. This battlefield interwoven into World War I style trenches and a burgeoning fleet of adapted commercial drones is tied together by everyday internet technology. The same software used by players to synchronize video game tactics now does so in a scenario with no pause nor reset button. This meshing of century-old tactics with state-of-the-art hobbyist tech, overlaid with the brutality of war, paints a harrowing portrait. We saw it in the eyes and streaming video feeds of that brave Ukrainian units hosting us on the front line amid their former homes and businesses now serving as operation centers. Ground troops with drones circling overhead know they're constantly under the watchful eyes of pilots a few kilometers away. Those pilots know they are potentially in crosshairs watching back. This feeling of exposure and lethal voyeurism is everywhere in Ukraine. Behind this front, commanders work in bunkers with internet connectivity that gives Ukraine a gamer's combat pace and the advantages of startup-like iteration. But during our visit this summer, it appeared this advantage was waning. Russia had adapted to Western weapons and Ukrainian techniques. Improved jamming and air defenses were increasingly grounding air power, putting more and more soldiers in the mud on a gridlocked front. For Ukraine, a breakthrough could lie in transforming their nascent drone startup ecosystem, over 200 companies, many with affiliated combat units, into a continuously evolving software platform. As Russia showcases advancements like the Orlan 10 and Lancet drones, S-400 air defenses and enhanced electronic warfare, all in seemingly inexhaustible quantities, Ukraine's response could be even faster evolving software that internetizes the battlefield with autonomy, AI and ad hoc networking. Rather than new hardware, new software and some clever tactics can hold the innovation high ground. Traditional militaries with their slow procurement systems have no playbook for this, but software startups do. Ukraine must win a startup war that constantly brings new systems and new software to the battlefield. At the heart of this strategy lies the drone, not just as an airborne device, but also as a potent software platform. Imagine drones that never miss, drones that never operate in isolation, drones with unbreakable communication lines, and drones that in swarms always prevail, all possible with software and all changeable all the time. Such a strategy would redefine warfare tactics by redefining its economics. En masse, low-cost drones may incapacitate million-dollar tanks or ships, creating a cost-exchange ratio that can bankrupt Russia's military and light Ukraine's path to victory. This cost imposition warfare will render obsolete many traditional military concepts and alter the global security landscape. The rapid software-driven nature of these systems will also accelerate the onset of AI-powered warfare. This technological leap, fully separating the human attacker from their target, foretells a redefinition of warfare and deterrence, one where mass, low-cost data and algorithms dominate offense, empowering attritable systems that make defense increasingly unaffordable. The specter of a never-ending AI arms race demands new modes of diplomacy to prevent escalatory threats. But progress cannot be stopped, only guided. Unlike another autonomous weapon, landmines that kill civilians daily in Ukraine, lethal drones must be locatable, limited in autonomous duration, and overseen by humans. All things software can ensure if guided by convention. As the cycle time of war quickens, so must every function supporting it, and so must the functions that deter it. From public debate to international laws and policies, will the world rise to this challenge? We hope so, just as we hope for victory in Ukraine. End of article. We have come to the halfway point of our program. You're listening to Time Magazine on Sight Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight Into Sound channel on HD4 or 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon, Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. In music news, our next article is titled What Beyoncé Gave Us, written by Brian Washington. On September 23rd and 24th, Houston was host to Beyoncé's brilliance. Beyoncé began with the operatic before dipping coolly into a deep trill. Beyoncé vogued with a team of glowing dancers. Beyoncé rapped, as brash and present as your favourite rapper's favourite rapper. There was no peak. Her performance simply escalated, ascending a mountain of precision with no visible climax, and then it ended. But in many ways, the Renaissance tour, which Beyoncé completed on October 1st, was an extension of her overarching ambition. Over nearly three decades, she has constantly reinvented herself. Her sound, her presentation, and her audience's expectations for what a performer can or should be or do have risen alongside her. The Renaissance album itself further underlined her prowess, scope. It is a celebration, among other things, of the black origins of disco and house music, black ballroom, vogue, drag. As a result, the life it's lived and will continue to live has taken very different forms from Beyoncé's previous projects. I've heard Thick at queer orgies in Oakland, California. I've heard Cozy between cocktails at brunch in LA. Earlier this year, I listened to Virgo's Groove in the smoking room of a sauna in Osaka, Japan, and every man beside me mumbled the chorus. Lately, I've spent more time outside Beyoncé's and my shared hometown than in, but it wasn't negotiable that I would be in Houston for this. It simply had to happen. What may have been the most remarkable component for me lay within the final moments. As the performers launched into Pure/Honey, the penultimate track, the stage was ceded to the dancers to vogue in a bright circle. Everyone who'd stood with Beyoncé throughout the night was given a moment, which was a deafening punctuation mark in a deliberately, deeply thesis that the performers and crews had spent nearly 3 hours constructing. The event was made possible by queerness and the culture of black queers across the decades, specifically. Seeing this in a packed stadium felt stunning to the point of elation. Because this fantasia for many folks watching in Houston dissipated immediately after. Texas is one of the most hostile states in the country for queer people. In the past year, more than 100 bills targeting LGBTQ communities were introduced in the Texas legislature, making up over 20% of anti-queer legislation that has emerged in the state governing bodies across the U.S. There are few areas of public life in the state where its government hasn't at least attempted to eradicate its queerness from visibility. Maybe this, too, is further evidence of Beyoncé's excellence. For a few hours, we were all privy to something better, a better way of being. Much talk is made of Beyoncé's otherworldliness, and our visible labour allows this. But what's more extraordinary is that she is entirely human. Calling her performances perfect would in some ways belie the many things they achieved. In that stadium, she expanded possibility, an even higher bar, more elusive and foundation-shifting. As I left the show both evenings, Houston's neighborhood, Montrose, felt energetic in a way it simply hadn't in some time. The streets were packed, the bars vibrated with energy, until security told us all to go home, shepherding folks onto the sidewalk. Eventually, we all split off and a pair of guys walked beside my boyfriend. and me shared our silence for a few blocks before we turned to each other, instinctively, and smiled and said to get home safe. This too felt like an extension of the moment, like the show will continue enveloping us, even still. End of article. In health news, our next article is titled, In Their Own Words, The Unique Stress of Growing Up Right Now and How Young Americans Are Coping. Written by Jamie Ducharme. To be a US teenager in 2023 is both the same as it ever was and astoundingly different from even a generation ago. Along with all the classic challenges of growing up, grades, parents, first loves, looms a crop of newer ones, TikTok, gun violence, political division, the whipsaw of COVID-19, the not-so-slow creep of climate change. The main domains are the same, school, home, family and peers, says Dr. Aisha Patton-Smith, a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Kaiser Permanente in Virginia. But the stressors that emerge within those domains have changed tremendously in a world where the internet and real life have largely blurred into one, with everything from school to social interaction now happening at least partially online, and a fire hose of bad news. Always only a swipe away. This new world has taken a toll on US teenagers, if the staggering data on adolescent mental health are any indication. In 2020, 16% of US kids ages 12 to 17 had anxiety, depression or both, a roughly 33% increase since 2016, according to an analysis by Health Policy Research Group KFF. The following year, 42% of US high school students said they felt persistently sad or hopeless. 29% reported experiencing poor mental health. 22% had seriously considered suicide. And 10% had attempted suicide, according to the US Centers for Diseases Control and Prevention. These data are sometimes used to argue that kids aren't as tough as they used to be, but kids see it differently. Other generations are telling us that we're a weak generation and we haven't lived through this and that, says 16-year-old Jasmine. But we're in a new world experiencing new things. They haven't experienced half of what we've experienced. It's not only big macro-level societal shifts that are having an effect. CDC data also shows that personal traumas like sexual violence, bullying and social isolation are concerningly common, particularly among teen girls and teens who do not identify as straight, two groups at particularly high risk for poor mental health. Of course, there's no single or simple explanation for these trends. You know, everybody's different, says 15-year-old LB. It's not just one issue around the world that can explain, oh, this is why this person's feeling this. Indeed, mental health issues are as diverse as the young people who experience them. Girls, says 14-year-old Malaya, live with unhealthy body and beauty standards, while boys aren't given as much space to be sad and be emotional, says 15-year-old Josiah. Kids who identify as neither boys nor girls may be caught in a crushing gender binary. That prevents self-expression, says 15-year-old Trey. And kids of color bear the tremendous weight of trauma, discrimination and safety threats, says 17-year-old JJ. With such varied experiences, there is no one-size-fits-all cure. The most important thing adults can do is listen to teenagers, says Dr. Anish Dube, chair of the American Psychiatric Association's Council on Children, adolescents and their families. Oftentimes, the folks that are missing from the conversation are the folks that are most affected, Dube says. Young people themselves are going to have the answers more than I, as an expert, will. It's about listening to them. In an effort to do just that, photojournalist Robin Hammond interviewed dozens of US teenagers from Georgia, Colorado and the Washington DC area about their mental health, the challenges they've faced and how they cope, from struggles with gender identity and gun violence to bullying and body image. Their words offer windows into the messy world of the US teenager. But their stories also offer hope to other kids growing up in that complex environment. Jack, 15 years old, says he's learned to overcome his anxiety by focusing on the present and has found the courage to tell kids who tease him exactly how they make him feel. Go have a one-on-one conversation and talk to them, he says. It may sound cringe. It may sound like something that you really don't want to do, but you have to trust me, from one teenager to another. it helps and it will work. In sports news, our next article is titled Prime is Money. How Deion Sanders flipped Colorado's fortunes and became the most talked about man in sports, written by Sean Gregory. On an autumn weekend in Boulder, the sports miracle of the season is clearer than the blue Rocky Mountain sky. Whereas for years the University of Colorado football team delivered Saturday misery, the Buffaloes enjoyed just four winning seasons in the past 20 years and finished 1-11 in 2022. Boulder may now be the hippest, happiest place in America. The Stampede, a Friday night pre-game pep rally down Pearl Street, used to feel more like a tiptoe. But on September 29th, the night before Colorado faced off against number 8, USC, the restaurants are full and the sidewalks packed. A handful of little kids even line the rooftop of a trattoria to watch the marching band play. A little before 6 a.m. Mountain Time, the next day, hundreds of University of Colorado fans, most wearing white cowboy hats, adorned with LED lights, have assembled in Farron Field, smack in the middle of campus. Some are students, others alums and locals, while a significant number have traveled from far afield, never having imagined that they'd have reason to gaze at those picturesque peaks in the backdrop. Fox Sports' Big Noon kickoff pregame show won't start for hours, but the revelers are ready. They're here to see Deion Sanders, or Coach Prime, a play on prime time, his nickname from his 1980s and 1990s heyday, who arrived as head coach in December, radically made over this year's term and turned Colorado into the biggest name in sports. Before kickoff, the sidelines at Colorado Stadium are now the place to be seen. There's rapper DaBaby hyping up the crowd. There are Sanders friends and fellow football Hall of Famers, Terrell Owens, Warren Sapp and Michael Irvin. Hey, that's basketball Hall of Famer Kevin Garnett and future baseball Hall of Famer CC Sabathia and rapper Simba. The VIPs wear a special credential around their necks, prime passes in the shape of the gold whistle Sanders uses in practice. Boulder County is 1.3% black, yet as one sideline spectator observes, the scene feels like Black Hollywood. And what's been happening on the field is as spectacular as what's happening off. As the Buffaloes charge back against the Trojans, slicing a 41-14 third quarter deficit to 48-41 with just under 2 minutes left, Folsom Field, filled with more than 54,000 roaring fans, felt like the epicenter of sports. Could Sanders' squad, which had already exceeded expectations, stimulated the college football economy and compelled more than 8 million people to watch Colorado beat Colorado State in double overtime after 2:15 a.m. Eastern Time in mid-September? ESPN's highest college football viewership figure at that hour. Pull off this monumental comeback? USC recovered the late onside kick to clinch the game, but Colorado's charge just added to the coach prime euphoria. The atmosphere is electric, man, DaBaby tells me before leaving the field. Look, it's never NFL game. Right now, this is the most exciting place to be in football. Swifties may disagree, but while the rumored relationship between Taylor Swift and Kansas City Chiefs Travis Kelce drives headlines and ticket sales, Coach Prime's efforts are much more far-reaching. At Colorado, he has the power to change not only the fate of the team, but also the multi-billion dollar college football industry. His success could open doors for more black head coaches at the highest levels of the college game, a long overdue development, especially given that teams with majority black players help generate, in some cases, north of $100 million in annual revenue for their schools. After decades of coaches protecting players from distractions, Sanders has invited cameras to embed with Colorado for the second season of Amazon's Coach Prime. His embrace of social media, exposure for players, they wear their Instagram handles on their practice jerseys, and their recently won right to capitalize on their name, image and likeness, NIL, could shake up the sport's stodgy DNA. Plus, after two successful seasons at Jackson State, a historically black college or university, HBCU, Sanders used the transfer portal, the still newish NCAA mechanism that lets players switch schools without sitting out a year, to overhaul Colorado's roster. He brought in 57 transfers, while more than 60 Colorado players left for other programs or ended their college football careers. In short, he treats college sports as what it is, a business. CU hired him to win, and win now. And he's doing it his way, with straight talk and unshakable confidence. In the world of college football, there's a certain expectation of how coaches should be and how they should act, says Dwayne The Rock Johnson, a former defensive lineman at the University of Miami, who won a national championship in 1991. Prime tore that playbook up and threw it out of the window. Some of Sanders' methods have proved unpopular. He was criticized for having DaBaby, who has been derided for using homophobic language and has had multiple run-ins with the law, give his team a pep talk about overcoming adversity. He's pushed players out the door. Many people are rooting for his failure, but that word, Sanders insists, isn't part of his vocabulary. Love Coach Prime, a ubiquitous presence in ads for Aflac, California Almonds and KFC, or hate him. You're paying attention. We're being unapologetically who we are, Sanders, 56 years old, tells me in an interview in Boulder, the week of the USC game. You can tell by everything that we're accomplishing right now that we're headed in the proper direction at a speed that is undeniably a lot more expeditious than many people would have suspected. Shoot, this is going to be good. It's just like the trailer of a movie you're seeing. Just wait until you see the whole darn movie. Sanders patrols his team's morning practices in a golf cart with Prime emblazoned on the front. A Prime bicycle and Prime Segway rest outside his office. Before one session, the team huddles around him. Line, you're going to have a great day. You're going to kick some butt up front, right? Sanders says, yes, sir. Players respond in unison. You're going to protect that quarterback, right? Yes, sir. Defensive line, we're going to get to the quarterback, right? Yes, sir. He drives from station to station to observe and occasionally weigh in. Sanders moves more gingerly these days because of blood clots. He had two toes in his left foot amputated in 2021. Get off the field, garbage. That's horrible, he says to one player who erred. You ran onto the field as if you were about to have a baby in 3 months, he tells a player who wasn't hustling enough for Coach Prime's liking. Hey guys, that was horrible offensively today. I want you all to know that, Sanders says at the end of a practice. There's not a commitment to excellence whatsoever. You're just going through the darn motions. Sanders eschews profanity, often saying darn where a curse word would do. But he reserves his biggest smile of the week for when two of his coaches, defensive coordinator Charles Kelly and defensive tackles coach Sal Cinceri, both of whom left Alabama, the premier program of the past 15 years, to take on this rebuilding project, get into a shouting match that devolves into an exchange of FUs. He appreciates their intensity. At one practice, David Kelly, Colorado's general manager and longtime Sanders confidant, shows me a text he got from Nike co-founder Phil Knight, who had talked to Sanders before Colorado faced Oregon in Eugene on September 23rd and met with Barack Obama at Nike headquarters a few days later. I greeted him with, "You're the second biggest celebrity I've talked to this week," Knight wrote. Little about Sanders' program is typical. "Is you working or twerking?" reads a sign on Sanders' office door. "Working or twerking" is one of multiple phrases including Coach Prime and its personal, for which he has filed for trademarks. A conference room houses his sneakers and hats. On Friday afternoon, a woman walks towards his door and asks, "Are that many people really in there?" Sanders doesn't allow shoes in his office and 11 pairs of shoes sit in front of the reception desk. A few minutes later, members of the documentary crew, his manager, Sanders' son Shiloh, a Colorado safety, Garnett, and fellow basketball Hall of Famer Paul Pierce file out of Sanders' space. These days, everyone wants time with Prime. Colorado's game against Oregon, a 42-6 blowout victory for the Ducks, drew 10.3 million viewers, making it one of the most watched college football games of the year. The school's online team store merchandise sales are up 892% year-to-date over 2022. Colorado Chancellor Philip DeStefano says out-of-state applications have climbed 40%. It's transformational, he says. Sanders is even developing a half-hour comedy with Kevin Hart's media company based on his journey and build as Entourage meets the gridiron, Sanders' team tells Time magazine exclusively. People are drawn to Hope Man, says Sanders. Shoot, we're David. We ain't got but a couple of stones here. We're playing against Goliath every week. We were 1-11 and now you're tripping about us? We're pulling people in, man. They just want a chance to be seen, to be heard, to be noticed, to be recognized. They just want to be pushed in the swing set of life every once in a while and say, wee, wee. One could dismiss these words as self-serving if Sanders weren't onto something, because it's not just celebrities who have flocked to town to pay homage to Sanders. The Rock, Lil Wayne, Offset and Key Glock have also made appearances since the start of the season. Fan after fan in Boulder mentions Coach Prime's inspiration. At the Colorado team store, Veronica Jones, a retired law enforcement officer from Charlotte, North Carolina, wearing gold-rimmed, fierce but fabulous glasses and a t-shirt for the HBCU Johnson C. Smith University, fished for Prime gear in the same area as a guy who looked like a member of ZZ Top. Her husband, Will Jones, noted that most of the black passengers on their flight to Denver were going to cheer on Sanders. It was like a family reunion, he says. Kedrick Mallory made the trip from Atlanta with friends and family, including his one-year-old son. I'm here to support the movement, says Mallory, a real estate broker. In my 42 years of living, I never thought of coming to Colorado. My son could have stayed at home with his grandmother, but I want him to be able to say, when I was 16 months old, I witnessed the Prime effect. When Sanders was rocking Jira curls and gold chains in the late 1980s, Neon Dion was another nickname back then. Few would have pegged him for a major college football coach, provider of hope and leader of men. His talent was indisputable, but his swagger rubbed many the wrong way. Everybody occupies two persons in their natural being, says Sanders now. People wish they could develop that other person a lot more. That other person says the things they want to say and does the things they want to do. Prime has been that cat, and I developed that cat a long time ago. Sanders grew up in Fort Myers, Florida, where his mother worked around the clock to support him. A two-time All-American at Florida State, Sanders won the Jim Thorpe Award, given to the top defensive back in the country, in 1988. Both the Atlanta Falcons and the New York Yankees drafted him. During a 1990 Yankees-Chicago White Sox game in the Bronx, Sanders got into a verbal exchange with White Sox catcher Carlton Fisk, who took exception to Sanders failing to run out a pop-out. Contemporaneous news reports said Sanders drew dollar signs in the batter's box dirt. Fisk seconded that account over the years. The exchange contributed to Sanders' image as an arrogant heel. But Sanders insists he drew no dollar signs, only markings to help position his feet. Carlton Fisk lied, he says. Sir, with all due respect, I would never do such a thing. Why would I lie about something like that? Fisk says. Check the tape. Regardless, Sanders rocketed to 1990s stardom. He made a cameo in MC Hammer's Too Legit to Quit video. He won back-to-back Super Bowls after the 1994-1995 seasons with the San Francisco 49ers and Dallas Cowboys, respectively. Years before Colorado, Sanders was creating culture. Dwayne Johnson was watching closely during these years. Over Zoom, I asked him about Sanders' influence on his own career, and he shows me goosebumps on his forearm. No one has ever asked me that, he says. So much of the character and the entity of The Rock came from Prime. One of the characteristics of the character of The Rock was talking in the third person. Dion would say certain things in the third person. I always found that so cool, because he walked the walk. We have come to the end of our program. I've been reading Time magazine. My name is Angus McVicar, and this has been a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas, since 1967.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.